Well, I was reading a report from pewresearch.org on whether the conversations and interactions that happen on social media will improve or get worse in the next 15 years. And as far as, conversations on social media usually are full of insults. There's not a whole lot productive going on. It's not really pretty when you have online social interactions most of the time. Just read the comment section on any YouTube video or something like that, and you see that things get ugly pretty quick. So the common consensus among the experts, so the people in this article that they viewed as experts, was they were pretty much on the same page that things are not going to improve in the next 15 years is their prediction. In fact, they'll stay the same or get worse. Now, Pew Research is not a Christian organization in and of itself. These experts, I don't believe, were coming from a Christian worldview. And so the reasons, they had like four or five specific reasons of why they thought things would not get better, but rather worse. And the first reason is, and I quote this from the article, it says, humans are self-centered and short-sighted, making them easy to manipulate. That's one of their main reasons. Here's what some of the experts said in comment on that. I don't know personally who any of these people are, but anyway, maybe you will. But Mark Brenneman, managing partner of iDare LLC, observed, human nature is unlikely to change. Zizi Papacharisi, who's professor of political science and professor and head of communication at the University of Illinois Chicago, observed, toxicity is a human attribute, not an element inherent to digital life. And then Alexa Raad, chief purpose and policy officer at Human Security, wrote, fundamentally, the same aspects of human nature that have ruled our behavior for millennia will continue to dictate our behavior, albeit with new technology. So what they're saying is, to summarize all of that, and again, I have limited experience at the University of Illinois Chicago, and it is not a very positive place towards Christianity. I don't think these people are coming at this from a Christian perspective, but they're saying the problem that you see with online discussions and the issue that we have is not a problem with technology. It's not the technology that's causing the insults and the bad behavior and the bad dialogue. It's the people operating the technology. It's the humans. Humans have some kind of fundamental element to them that are toxic, according to one of them, where there's a problem. And again, this is not a Christian background, but for Christians, that sounds a whole lot like sin nature to us, right? They probably wouldn't sign up to say, I agree with sin nature, but they can see that clearly. And they're not coming from a Christian background, that there is something fundamentally wrong with humans where we have this self-centered approach where we want what we want, so we do what we do to get what we want, even if that's at the expense of other people. So it's clear, even to people who are not necessarily coming from a Christian background. So it doesn't take long or a hard look around our culture and see that we're very selfish. We are all about satisfying our physical cravings and whatever it is that we want. And that's certainly true when it comes to sex and relationships that we have. You look at our married statistics inside the church and outside of the church and the reasons that marriages fall apart, and you can see that we're not very good at living according to what God wants instead of what our own selfish desires have. And you see that it's causing great harm to our society and our culture and our families and churches. Our modern American family, even the idea of what a family should be, has been assaulted and even destroyed in some cases, where people don't even know what a family should look like according to what God has mandated in Scripture. And so somebody that I heard a couple weeks ago said that our culture is in complete sexual anarchy against God, and I would agree with that. You can see that with our family structures and how everything has been destroyed and everything is in chaos. So we have been in Matthew chapter 5, where Jesus has been teaching about having our hearts, our thoughts, our beliefs, and attitudes made right according to the ways of God. So making our heart like Jesus so that our outer behavior looks like Jesus. And we're going to continue that today. We're going to be in Matthew 5, 27 through 37, if you want to turn there. And we're going to see what our heart's attitude should be when it comes to marriage and the family. What should our heart attitude be towards our spouse within marriage? What should a Christian's heart attitude look like as opposed to our secular culture's attitude and heart attitude? I'm going to argue among other things, ultimately, so if you miss everything, this is where I'm going with it, is that it should be a self-sacrificing, selfless attitude rather than self-gratification and going after what we want, where we're using our spouse or our partner for our own gratification rather than loving them self-sacrificially. That's the difference. So we're going to have 4 points today. We're going to have 4 B's. I'm proud of myself because I don't do this often. So they start with the letter B, right, and the word B. So 4 B points. We'll see 3 attributes we need to have to please God in our marriages, followed by a summarizing application. So we're looking for 4 points, 3 attributes, 1 application. So let's look at Matthew 5, 27 through 30 to start. I'm going to kind of break our passage here down into sections. So Matthew 5, 27 through 30 to start with. It should be on the screens behind me as well. It says, "You have heard that it was said, 'You shall not commit adultery.' But I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lustful intent has already committed adultery with her in his heart. If your right eye causes you to sin, tear it out and throw it away, for it's better that you lose one of your members than that your whole body be thrown into hell. And if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away, for it's better that you lose one of your members than that your whole body go into hell." So the first action that we're called to here, the first attribute I think that we ought to have, is that we need to be free from adultery of the heart. As Christians, we need to be free from adultery of the heart. Now, what is adultery of the heart? It's lust. So what we need to do is we need to be free from this sexual lust. So last week, and as we'll see again and again, Jesus starts his teaching from the common teaching that his listeners would have heard from the Pharisees and the scribes. So he gives them the teaching, and then he expounds on it and points to the heart attribute that these teachings are pointing to, that the teaching from the law of Moses, what it's pointing to. So he says, "You've heard it said, 'You shall not commit adultery.'" So that's the 7th of the 10 commandments that God gave Israel. Pretty basic stuff. You shouldn't take somebody else's spouse and sleep with them. That's not right. Pretty basic. Everybody would have been on board with that, his listeners, and hopefully you're on board with that too. Pretty basic, and they would have heard that certainly. In verse 28, Jesus has the same in Greek, but I say. We talked about that last week, where instead of in English it says "but I say," but in Greek it says "I, but I say," and I think that "I," that pronoun there, is used to emphasize Jesus' authority. So it's saying I, Jesus, the King of Kings, I, Jesus, the author of this law, I have authority to explain the law and to explain what this law, this command is really pointing to. So I think it's pointing to his authority. And by the way, he does this, I'm not going to mention it really anymore, but every time throughout this whole sermon, he states, "You've heard that it was said," and then he gives the teachings in the Old Testament, and then, "but I say to you," it's that same construction. So emphasizing his authority to explain this. So we saw that last week, we'll see it this week, and it's going on throughout this Sermon on the Mount that we're going through. So Jesus is going to get at the heart of the command, and Jesus says that everyone who looks at a woman with lustful intent has already committed adultery with her in his heart. So that would have been shocking to his audience, because really the common thinking of most of the Jews and the teachers of this time was that this law about adultery was about taking what belongs to somebody else. So it was about, if you defraud your brother of his wife by taking her and committing adultery with her, it was more of an act of theft, is what they saw it as. And that's not completely wrong. Committing adultery with another man's wife or husband would be taking what belongs to somebody else. It's violating their right and wronging them in some way. So adultery is an act of theft, but that's not what the 7th commandment was primarily pointing to. The 10th commandment, if you remember it, that says, "You do not covet your neighbor's wife," that's pointing to this act of taking what does not belong to you. You're coveting, you're desiring what does not belong to you, and it goes on beyond that to coveting other things of your neighbor. So it is an act of theft, but the 7th command is pointing more to the heart issue of lust, sexual desire in the heart, lusting after what is not appropriate within the boundaries that God has set. That's what that's pointing to. So they would have been thinking, yeah, adultery is wrong because you're taking your brother's wife. And that's not wrong, but Jesus is pointing to more than that. He's saying, okay, we're getting to the heart issue here. It's not just about defrauding your brother. It's about what's going on in the heart. So Jesus is saying here, You know that it's wrong to commit adultery. I'm telling you that you are guilty of the very sin of adultery if you are looking at a woman lustfully. And that raises the bar quite a bit from what everybody else taught. So if you're thinking the bar is, as long as I'm not sleeping with somebody else's wife or husband, that's a far different bar than if you're just looking at someone with lustful intent, and that's adultery. That's quite a different standard. So many people of his listeners would have thought with this teaching that, you know, you could check out whoever you wanted to check out. If you see a beautiful woman walking by, you see a handsome guy, and you want to look at them lustfully, that's not adultery. You're not sleeping with them. You're not taking somebody else's spouse. You can do whatever you want to in your mind with that person, and that's not adultery because you're not taking somebody else's spouse. But Jesus raises the bar to, if you are thinking lustfully about someone in your heart, then you have committed the very same sin of adultery. You are guilty in the court of God of committing adultery, just like the person who has committed sex with somebody else's spouse. So what that means practically for us then is that if we're thinking lustful thoughts about a man or a woman who's not our spouse, we are sinning and we are committing adultery. And that's true of if you're married or not married, right? There's not one set of rules for those who are married. You're like, oh, okay, now you can't lust after other people now that you're married. It's true if you're not married that you cannot lust after those who are not your spouse. That'd be everybody, any other man or woman. So if we're looking lustfully at somebody at the gym or on the street or on TV or on a computer screen, we are committing adultery of the heart. That's what Jesus is talking about. If we're thinking lustfully about people in our minds, within our imagination, we are committing adultery of the heart. If we do acts of affection with somebody while we're dating them with lustful intent, it's not about affection, it's about our selfish gratification with somebody that we're not married to, that is lust, that is adultery of the heart. This means that for a Christian, it is sinful to check somebody out. And you know what I'm talking about. So there's a difference between noticing that somebody's beautiful. So if you're somewhere and you see a beautiful woman walk by or a handsome man, you say, wow, that's a beautiful woman or that's a handsome guy. That's not wrong. That's noticing somebody that is beautiful. But the difference is when you look and you say, wow, you look up and down, that's a beautiful woman, or that's a handsome guy, or hey, honey, I think you need to start going to the gym more. And so that's when you have crossed over, right, from noticing someone's beauty. And I've heard that excuse for Christians. Well, you know, I just spent 30 seconds noticing somebody's beauty, you know, and there's a line that's crossed where you start lusting after somebody in your heart. You're checking somebody out. That's wrong for a Christian to do. That's adultery of the heart. That's true if you're looking at somebody in person, so you know somebody on the street or somebody on the beach or somebody wherever you are, or that's true if you are looking at somebody in a movie or on a computer screen or even in your own mind. It's all adultery of the heart. So what that means then, another application, moving this into something else, is that masturbation is sinful when we're thinking about anyone or any situation other than our spouse because we are fixated on and we are enjoying sexual pleasure outside of the realm of marriage. If we are thinking lustfully about somebody who is not our spouse, whether it's a physical act that accompanies that or not, that is adultery of the heart and it is sinful for us to do. People have asked me, okay, Chris, what verse in the Bible says masturbation is a sin? Because you're not going to find that word in the Bible. But I point him right here. This is where I see it. Because it's not about the physical act that's going on. It's about what's going on in your mind and in your heart. Are you thinking, the key question for us is, are you thinking lustfully about somebody who is not your spouse in whatever you're doing? And if it's yes, then we are committing adultery of the heart. And masturbation then would be a sin for us to do, whether you are thinking about somebody in person, whether you're lusting after them in person, whether it's somebody on a computer screen, whether it's a real person, whether it's not a real person. It is sinful because you are committing adultery with somebody in your heart. You are enjoying sexual pleasure outside of the realm, outside of marriage between a husband and wife, and therefore it is sinful. Our culture is in such rebellion against God sexually, it's hard for many Christians even to know what's right and wrong when it comes to certain sexual activity. Because our culture, what we're seeing and what we're inundated with is counter to what God would have us do. And so what our culture thinks is normal is oftentimes sinful for us. Now, don't hear me say that sex is bad. I want to give that clarification. Sex is a good thing. God created it, but it is to be enjoyed within the boundaries that God has set it, which is between a husband and a wife within marriage. It's to be enjoyed within that capacity. It is a good thing. It is not a bad thing. It is not a dirty thing. But when it is enjoyed outside of those parameters, whether in our mind or physically, then it is sinful, and it damages us, not only our relationship with the Lord, but it damages our emotional relationship with our spouse or future spouse, and it damages our sexual relationship with our present spouse or future spouse. I very much believe that that's the case. It damages relationships. Even if you're not married and you think, this doesn't feel like it's going to damage my relationship with my spouse, it does. It affects your future sexual relationship. This standard of not thinking lustfully about others is shocking to most people in the world. I had a Chinese roommate in college, so one semester in college I didn't have a roommate. My roommate left school. Something happened to his roommate. He had come to the United States from China, and part of his education is to learn English, right? That's part of why he's in the United States, part of why he's trying to learn. And part of that is the school wanted him to live with an English-speaking roommate who could help him with English so that every day he would be in conversation with somebody who's speaking English. So when his roommate left and my roommate left, they strongly urged me. I'm still not sure I had a choice in the matter today, but anyway, they strongly urged me to live with him, and then I could be kind of his English-speaking buddy. So that meant when he heard a word that he didn't know before, he would come to me to ask what it meant, and I would do my best to try to explain it. And so one day, and I don't know how this happened, but he heard the word masturbation. And of course, that was not in his English vocabulary, which is probably a good thing. But that unfortunately meant for me that my role was to explain what this was. And that was not what I signed up for, okay? So I was not happy about the situation. So I tried to explain it and not be crass and not be crude. I was uncomfortable. He could tell I was uncomfortable. And so he thought, you know, when I was trying to explain this and he didn't know what I was talking about, he thought, boy, whatever this is must be really bad. Like, I don't know what this is. And so he figured it out with my explanations, and he had this translation device thing, and he figured it out. When he figured it out, he said, I know what you're talking about. He said, this is no big deal in China. This is no big deal at all. And I could tell he was thinking, Chris, why are you even feeling uncomfortable about this? Like, why? This is a norm. This is a normal expectation. And it's not just in Chinese culture, but it's in American culture as well. And if you look at statistics and if you've ever had a conversation about something like this, which is awkward, but with somebody on the street, then you know the norm is for anybody in society, especially males, that the expectation is and the norm is and what people think is pretty normal is you are involved with pornography and you are involved in masturbation. That's just a norm. And if you are against that, you are a prude. You are ridiculous. You might as well make yourself a monk or a nun by saying otherwise. And so that is the norm, and that is what our culture teaches as normal, and that is what the normal expectation is, that this stuff is going on. And Christians oftentimes are confused about this, and Christians oftentimes think it's the norm as well. They see it's no big deal, the kind of the attitude that my roommate had. You know what? It's not a big deal. I mean, it's not like you're taking somebody's spouse or something like that. It's not hurting anybody, right? It's no big deal. But it is a big deal because it's a sin. It's a sin that Jesus had to die on the cross for. It's a sin that has eternal significance. It's a sin, adultery of the heart, that makes us worthy to go to hell. It's a sin worthy of eternal significance. It's no small deal. It is a big deal, just as any sin is. It's not greater than other sins necessarily, but it is a sin with eternal significance. And Jesus gets into this, talks about the seriousness of this in verses 29 through 30. He teaches that if your right eye, and he says right eye and right hand, because in the society of that day, your right hand, your right eye, your right leg, whatever. That was your best eye, best hand, best leg, whatever. So if your best appendage, your best eye, your best hand causes you to sin, he says, you should cut it off because it's better to have that removed. It's better to be maimed in your everyday life than to end up for it to cause you to sin and go to hell. Now, before you pull out your scalpel, okay, because honestly, probably all of us should be missing eyes and hands and things like that, Jesus is not telling us to mutilate ourselves, I don't think. Now, there have been Christians in Christian history who have taken this very literally and have enacted upon this verse, but I think that misses the point. Because let me ask you this. Can a blind man lust? And can a man who has no hands act in a sexually inappropriate way? Right? And the answer should be yes and yes, right? Because if you can, the problem is the mind. If you can sin sexually with somebody in your mind, that's not your eyes' fault. It kind of goes back to what I talked about with the opening image. The fact that discussions fall into this toxic, negative, unproductive state on technological forums is not the fault of technology. It's the fault of the people who are controlling technology, the heart of the people who are doing that. In the same way, lust in the heart, adultery in the heart, it's not the eye's fault that it has observed something, right? That it's doing what God created it to do. It is the problem of our heart. It's the problem of our mind. So what we really need to fix it is a lobotomy? Anyway, removing your brain is what the problem is. You need a brain transplant. And of course, if you have another human brain, you're going to fall into the same problem. And so thank the Lord for the Holy Spirit coming into our lives that transforms us more and more like Christ. That is our spiritual surgery. But the problem is our heart. The problem is our mind. So even if you take a man who has never seen anything before, he's been born blind, and you still have sexual desires, and so of what he knows of women through voice and everything else, he can still lust in his mind. He can still imagine things. He can still commit adultery of the heart in his mind, even though he's not seen. So the problem is not the physical members, but the principle of radical amputation, so removing what is causing the sin, that is very applicable. So what that might look like for us is, if we have trouble, let's say you have trouble not looking at people lustfully when you go to the beach because of people's skimpy swimwear. Other women or men are getting more skimpy all the time with their swimwear, which makes me uncomfortable when I have to go shopping for swimwear at the store. But anyway, if you have trouble not looking at somebody lustfully when you're on the beach, and that's just a common struggle because of what people wear, then amputate the beach from your life. Don't go to the beach. You don't need to be there. It's okay. Don't go to the beach or the pool. If you have trouble looking at people lustfully when you're at the pool, don't go to the pool. Or if you have trouble when you are watching certain movies or shows and they cause you to lust, don't watch those movies or shows. Get rid of them. Or if you have trouble with certain books, don't read those books. You don't need to read them. Get rid of them. Or if you have video games that you play that cause you to lust, get rid of them. Don't play those games. Amputate those parts of your lives. Or if you have trouble with watching pornography, get rid of your smartphone and get a prepaid phone that doesn't have access to the internet. Remove that. You don't need the internet on your phone. You'll be okay, believe it or not. You'll be okay, okay? So get a phone that doesn't have access to the internet. Or if you have trouble with pornography, don't get on your computer unless you have to be and you have people who will hold you accountable who are in the room with you when you are on the computer. That's the principle of radical amputation. If it's causing you to sin, you don't need it. Get rid of it. It's not worth sinning for. It's not worth leading you astray. If you have trouble with lusting while you're by yourself doing homework or working from home, as many people do now on your computer, then I wish I could tell you just don't do homework or don't work anymore, but that's not practical. You can't do that, unfortunately. But work in public, or especially if you can, around people who will hold you accountable. Be around other people where put yourself in a position or in an atmosphere where you are less tempted to lust. Flee temptation. That's the idea. Get rid of anything in your life that causes you to sin or leads you astray. So it's not about just what you do, but it's about what you think about. Jesus is getting at adultery of the heart, lust of the heart. And lust always does affect, not only because it's a sin, our relationship and fellowship with the Lord, as Christians, but it also affects our relationship or future relationship, sexual experience with our spouse. It really does in a negative way. Speaking of spouses, let's look at what Jesus has to say in verse 31 through 32. He says this, he says, "It was also said, whoever divorces his wife, let him give her a certificate of divorce. But I say to you that everyone who divorces his wife, except on the ground of sexual immorality, makes her commit adultery. And whoever marries a divorced woman commits adultery." So what we see here is that we need the attribute of loyalty. So our second point is be loyal to your spouse even when it's hard. Be loyal to your spouse even when it's hard. Jesus again states what his listeners would have been taught, that when a man divorces his wife, he needs to give her a certificate of divorce, showing that she has been divorced. This comes straight from Deuteronomy chapter 24, verse 1. That's straight from the law of Moses. So it stated that if a man found something indecent in his wife, he could divorce her. Now, during Jesus' time, there were two schools of thought. There was a lot of debate about this passage in Deuteronomy 24 among the Jewish leadership about what this indecent act is or what it constitutes, how far it goes or how light it could be. So there were two schools of thought, the Hillel school of thought, and they believed that this passage taught that if a man found anything indecent, as in anything that the man didn't like, he could divorce her. So let's say his wife burnt toast in the morning. She's out, okay? Certificate of divorce, you don't make breakfast well enough, you're out. And they would say that's a legitimate reason to get divorced according to the law of Moses. So that would kind of correspond to today our society's laws on divorce, where if somebody wants out for any reason, they can get divorced. Except back then, the husband had the right to divorce. It was really hard for a woman to get divorced on her own. Now, the other school of thought was the Shammai school of thought, and they thought that this indecent act had to be a very serious offense, mainly adultery. So this had to be something really big. You couldn't just divorce her for burning the toast. It had to be a serious offense, and then you could give her a certificate of divorce. So that's the context that Jesus steps into here in this teaching. And Jesus steps into the situation. He declares that anyone who divorces his wife makes her commit adultery. He says that whoever marries a divorced woman commits adultery. So there's very little room for divorce and remarriage here. The only exception he lists is sexual immorality, he says here. Now, we're going to talk more about all of this when we cover Matthew 19. So I'm not going to be spending a lot of time on these verses because in Matthew chapter 19, when we come to that, Jesus expounds upon this whole teaching of marriage and divorce at greater length. So I'll hit it more fully there. But for now, let me just say this. So the Greek word for sexual immorality here is porneia, from which we get the word pornography. And I believe that this includes, the idea here of Matthew's intent in writing this, includes certainly adultery, so cheating on your spouse with somebody else, but I think it's broader than that to extreme sexual sin. And I'll just leave it there, but I think that's the exception clause where Jesus says if there is extreme sexual sin, including adultery, going on, then a spouse can divorce his or her spouse. Now, so any other reason to divorce and remarry is illegitimate according to Jesus' teaching. Now, I would include this. You're not going to find it here. I'll just throw this out there. Again, I'm going to get into more of this when we hit Matthew 19. But I would say, in my opinion, that another ground for divorce that you won't find here in this passage is if there is abuse where a spouse or children are in danger. I think that's a legitimate grounds for divorce. Again, you're not going to find that here. Jesus isn't talking about that, but I think that's another exception clause, I suppose you could say, to marriage and divorce. But anyway, I'll leave that there. This would have made Jesus' audience very uncomfortable, this whole teaching that he gave them, because he probably had several people in his audience who had not followed this passage and this teaching according to the way Jesus is teaching it. They had either divorced illegitimately or remarried illegitimately. There would have been men there who caused their ex-wife to commit adultery. And you might ask, you know, how in the world could a man make his wife commit adultery? What's Jesus saying? How is that even possible? What, How does that make sense? So again, back then, a wife, it was really hard for her to get a divorce. It was mainly up to the husband. And so, again, let's suppose he divorces her frivolously for whatever reason he decides. He could divorce her, give her a certificate of divorce, and she's gone. And at this time, a single woman, it would have been very hard for her to provide for herself and her family. It'd be very hard to make an income. She couldn't go out and start working for Caterpillar or Subaru or something like that. She would have been in a life of poverty. For example, think about this happened many years before Jesus, but the circumstances are very similar. Ruth and Naomi from the book of Ruth, right? Ruth was not single because of divorce, but because of death, but a single woman trying to provide for herself and her family. That was a difficult thing. So what you needed was, usually your husband would provide. So a single woman then would need to be married to be provided for. But the divorce was probably not her choice. It's really up to the husband. So if she burns the toast or whatever, he has her kicked out. She could be doing everything that she could to be serving the Lord well in her marriage and in her life. And then here she is on the street, destitute, and to be provided for, she may need to be remarried. Now, that would be an act of adultery, according to this, because it was an illegitimate divorce. But notice that God puts the responsibility for that act of adultery not on the wife who remarries, but on the husband who divorced her in the first place. So the responsibility is, okay, look, husband, you divorced your wife illegitimately. She didn't really have control of that. She's remarried to be provided for. The responsibility for that whole mess, that lies on the husband then. He has made her commit adultery. That's what's going on here. And so the responsibility and the sin falls on his shoulder. So Jesus, again, with all of this in the Sermon on the Mount, he's getting at a heart issue. He's saying that a husband and a wife need to be loyal to one another. They shouldn't just divorce willy-nilly because they're unhappy, or somebody's toast got burnt or something like that. This teaching would have been somewhat countercultural at the time. There were some sectors of Jewish society that would have been mostly okay with this, but others definitely not. So even when a husband is not happy with his wife, Jesus is saying, he needed to stick it out or risk being responsible for her adultery as well as abandoning his own oath to the Lord when he married her, because he had promised not only her and her family, but the Lord, that he would stay married to her and until death do they part. And if he doesn't do that, then he has violated his covenant with the Lord and with his wife. So what that means for us then is, we need to be loyal to our spouse, even when things are hard. We need to be loyal, we need to stay married, and we need to serve them well. We need to be men and women of our word, and that kind of transitions into our third point, which is what we need to be, is we need to be men and women of our word. This is the third attribute we see today. We need to be men and women of our word. Look with me at Matthew 5, 33 through 37. It says, again, you have heard that it was said to those of old, you shall not swear falsely, but shall perform to the Lord what you have sworn. But I say to you, do not take an oath at all, either by heaven, for it is the throne of God, or by the earth, for it is his footstool, or by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. And do not take an oath by your head, for you cannot make one hair white or black. Let what you say be simply yes or no. Anything more than this comes from evil. So Jesus is relaying the teaching of Leviticus 19:12 here, as the teaching that his audience would all know and have heard. The Israelites were commanded by Moses not to promise they would do something in God's name, give an oath, by the name of Yahweh, I'm going to do whatever it is, and not fulfill it. They were commanded, if you do that, you need to do what you've promised you are supposed to do. And so they would have heard that, they would have known that, they were not to swear falsely. Now, because of this law, religious leaders at the time of Jesus had created and parsed this fairly complex list of ways that you could swear and what was binding and what was not binding. So, for example, if you swore by the name of Yahweh that you were going to do something, you better do that 100% because that's what Leviticus says, okay? So you had to do that. But if you swore that you were going to do something by heaven and earth, you know, by heaven and earth, I'm going to do whatever it is, that's not binding because that's not close enough to God. But swearing towards Jerusalem, if you say, I swear towards Jerusalem that I'm going to do that, that was binding. But if you swear by Jerusalem, it's not binding, okay? So If that doesn't make sense to you, I'm with you. I don't understand all the parsing of that. So it's these word games. Basically, what they were doing is the verbal equivalent of the, if you remember on the playground, somebody says, I promise I'm going to do this or not do this, but they have their hand behind their back, crossing their fingers, right? And then at the end, they're like, oh, I crossed my fingers. I don't have to do this, right? And you're like, oh. It's a verbal equivalent of crossing your fingers, right? They would swear by things, and they had these word games. If they swore by a certain thing, they weren't bound to it, and they say, well, you know, that's not close enough, so I really don't have to do this. So Jesus comes along, and he says instead that people shouldn't take an oath at all by anything, whether by heaven or earth or Jerusalem. They all have to do with God, and indirectly they all call upon the name of the Lord because they all belong to him. God is sovereign over everything. God dwells in heaven. God is in charge over Jerusalem. God is in charge of even the hair on their own heads, because they don't have sovereignty over their own bodies or any of these places. So they shouldn't swear by anything. They all belong to God. It's not that one oath is less binding than another. If you give an oath, you better fulfill it, is what he's saying. And so Jesus is saying that all the Pharisees and scribes' little technicalities were pointless and didn't get them off the hook. Now in verse 37, Jesus explains that his followers' yes should simply be yes, and their no meaning no. So what that means for us is we should be men and women who, we don't need to take oaths. When we say we're going to do something, we do it. Even if we didn't say, you know, Lord, witness against me if I don't do this. If we say yes, we need to do it. If we say we're not going to do something or we didn't do something, we need to not do it. We need to be men and women of our word who do what we say. We don't need to be taking oaths because people can take our word seriously when we say yes or when we say no. We're going to back that up. We need to fulfill our promises. Now, there's some controversy over this passage. I don't believe that Jesus is forbidding anyone to make promises outright or to swear by a higher authority. My reasoning for this is that God himself took oaths in the Old Testament. I want us to look at a couple passages about this. Look at Hebrews 6:19, where they're referencing what God did in the Old Testament. Hebrews 6:17. So it says, so in God desired to show more convincingly to the heirs of the promise the unchanging character of his purpose, he guaranteed it with an oath. So God himself took an oath. Of course, God is completely trustworthy. He doesn't need to take an oath. He shouldn't ever have to, because people should trust God at his word. God has a 100% fulfillment rate on what he promises. You see that throughout Scripture. But he took an oath to convince the unbelieving hearts of Israel. Look with me at Romans 1:9, because we see Paul himself take some oaths. Romans 1:9 says, for God is my witness, so God witness against me, that's what he's saying, whom I serve with my spirit in the gospel of his Son, that without ceasing I mention you, and then always in prayers in verse 10, that he's praying for them. Look with me at 2 Corinthians 1:23. Paul here again says, but I call God to witness against me. God, witness against me if what I say is not true. It was to spare you that I refrained from coming again to Corinth. So if God does this and Paul does this in the inerrant word of God, I don't think it's necessarily a sin to take an oath all the time. So practically, I don't think this means that Christians are forbidden from taking oaths in court, like if you have to go to court and say, you know, I promise to tell the truth and nothing but the truth, even though it really means nothing to people these days, but it should, and it doesn't mean that we are forbidden from doing that. But what this means is we as Christians should be people, we shouldn't have to ever take oaths, because I automatically distrust someone if they have to be qualifying what they say by saying, you know, God testify against me, or I swear on the Bible that what I'm saying this time is really the truth, or whatever. That implies that most of the time they're not telling the truth, and they need to swear by a higher authority. As Christians, we need to be people who, when we say we're going to do something, we do it. When we say we're not going to do something, we don't do it. We need to be men and women of our word, where we don't need oaths, because we just say yes, we say no, and what we say we're going to do, we do. We need to be men and women of our word. Now, how does that relate to what we've been talking about with lust and loyalty in marriage? Well, that means that when we promise to love our spouse in good and bad times, sickness and in health, till death do us part, when we make those vows, we need to keep our promise to God and stay married even when marriage is hard. because it is hard. Not only stay married, but be faithful in marriage. So not just, our standard isn't just, well, you know, I stayed married. You know, I live separate from my spouse. We haven't seen each other in 10 years, but we're technically married, right? So we've done this. It's not just staying married. The standard is work through and resolve the problems when they're hard. Be married. Serve one another well. When you hit rocky patches, you remain loyal and you work through the problems as best as you can, and you maintain your oath, you maintain your promise that you made to your spouse, to their family, to your witnesses at your wedding, and to God, that you are a man or a woman of your word. We need to be men and women who keep our promises, not just in marriage, but especially within our context, what I've been talking with in marriage. That means that also when we promise that we are going to love our spouse and nobody else, we're not going to have a lady on the side or a guy on the side, that we stay loyal to our spouse. We're not committing adultery in our minds or in our hearts or anything like, or physically as well, that we are loyal, we are men and women of our word. So our ultimate application today is we need to be loyal to our spouse from our heart. Our heart attitude towards our spouse needs to be one of loyalty, it needs to be one of self-sacrifice, needs to be one of love. That's what our heart should be in marriage. That's the difference that a Christian heart attitude, mind attitude, the way we think should be, as opposed to the rest of the world. The world gets married, and you see this in Disney movies and everything else. The reason you get married is for your happiness, right? To be fulfilled, to be happy. It is your personal self-gratification. That is the reason you get married. Now, I'm not saying that you don't have happiness in marriage. I hope you do. There's a problem if there is no happiness in your marriage. There's something is askew there, but that is not fundamentally our attitude. That is not the reason that we are married. That is not the condition that our marriage continues on, is our own happiness or what we get out of it. It is to love the other person. And if we're loving one another self-sacrificially, then you're going to have that joy. You're going to have that happiness. You're going to have that blessing from that. But we need to be men and women who are loyal to our spouse or our future spouse. If you're in here and you're not married and you plan to be married one day, then we need to be loyal to them. Our society has so many failed marriages because men and women are pursuing their own selfish desires over God and over their spouse. They're married or they want to enter into a relationship to get what they want. They want what they want. They're going to do what they do, no matter what the expense is going to be, no matter what God says or anybody says, because they are trying to fulfill their own selfish desires, their own lustful desires. There's no selfless love there. There's no loyalty. People don't give their spouse their whole heart. Instead, the heart is fully selfish. So we need to be loyal from the heart. And if we're loyal from our heart, we'll do our best to rid our heart of adultery. We will rid not only our actions, but our heart. Anytime there's adulterous lust coming up in our heart, we do our best to battle against them. Again, we're sinners. We're selfish. Very likely we're going to fail at this, right? And that's where repentance and forgiveness and the grace of God, we're thankful for it, because none of us would be here without the grace of God. We all deserve to be walking around without eyes and hands and everything else. But we need to do our best to rid adultery in our heart at the source. And if we do this, we'll be loyal to our spouse. We'll keep loving them even when we don't feel like it. When we feel like they're being grumpy or stubborn or being obstinate or hard to love, which there are moments like that, I know I am sometimes with Crystal, then we stay loyal, we stay married, we self-sacrifice, we work through the problems. We don't just decide, well, you know, this isn't fun anymore. I'm going to go find somebody else who can make better breakfast and who is less grumpy and better attitude and better looking and all that stuff. We maintain loyalty to our husband or to our wife. We don't depart from them until death, because that's what we've promised. We'll be men and women who keep our promise of marriage to God. Now, Christians in America, unfortunately, we do a terrible job at these things. You look at statistics of divorce rates and infidelity within marriage and all of that, and the church is basically on the same level as the rest of the world. So there is all kinds of mess, confusion, misinformation, bad beliefs, just lack of a desire to serve the Lord in our marriage, all kinds of things. We do a bad job at this. So I know this passage is very applicable to us and in our society today, in our church today, in America. It's as relevant as ever. We as Christians must be those who are free from adultery, even at the heart level, not just in what we're doing, but at the heart level. Because, again, adultery doesn't just happen where one day you wake up and you're like, oh, well, you know what? I feel like committing adultery today, and I'm going to do that. It's a matter of the heart and a progression of the heart, much like murder, what we talked about last week, where you have that bitterness that develops, that grows, and then ultimately there's murder. You don't just wake up one day and be like, you know what? I'm going to murder somebody today. It comes out of what's in the heart, and that grows and grows and then is produced in behavior. And so Jesus is getting at a heart level here where we need to address adultery at the heart level. We cannot give in to selfish lusts. We need to be people of our word, especially when it comes to our marriage vows. We need to be loyal to our husband or wife, even when it's hard. We need to be loyal from the heart. Just as we are to be like Jesus in our heart by yielding our heart to him, we must be loyal to our spouse and yield our heart over to them and love them self-sacrificially. It's when we get married, life, well, ultimately, it should be about Jesus, but life is even less about us when we get married. It is about them. When we have kids, even less about us and more about loving them. It's self-sacrificial love. It's loyal love, just as God loves us loyally. We need to love them self-sacrificially because that's how God loves us. And if our heart is like Jesus and we love like Jesus, the self-sacrificial, loyal, unconditional love, that's full of mercy and grace, then that our marriages, Christian marriages in the United States, will look a lot better statistically than they are. The divorce rate will be lower. I think there'll be greater happiness. The family structure will be much better than what we've seen today. And so we need to do that as Christians, is address adultery in the heart, address our deceitfulness and lies in the heart, our selfishness in the heart. We need to rid that out of our heart, and we need to love our spouse loyally and self-sacrificially. And that's very countercultural, because our culture does not do that well.